welcome back to episode 13 now of the Dratt and Drake Veterinary Podcast.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for coming back. You know, I don't think we have it too many repeaters. How you been?
You up.
Yeah. Hopefully. It's Dratt and Drake now, so we kind of have to keep it consistent. Can't go back. How you been since I last spoke to you?
Doing well. Went to a concert yesterday.
Okay. Yeah, I think you were telling me she's a big rock star.
Well, a fan of rock stars.
That's true, yeah. Okay.
She's not a musician herself.
No, not yet.
No. I mean, I guess I can save it for the Oma and Sarcoma.
Oh, fair. Okay. But you guys had a good time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, Mika had her physical therapy. We saw it. We had a consult with someone, and yeah, we're just working on these kind of motor skills. Not that she has any significant issues, but, you know, of course. You know what? Yeah, let's save that for the Oma Sarcoma.
Perfect.
Today's topic is something that at least I personally have thought a lot about. And I think everyone who's in the veterinary field, whether you're a vet student kind of prepping for it, or you've been likely in your first year, you've second, triple, quadruple guessed yourself. But what makes a good veterinarian, or what is the definition of a good veterinarian?
Depends who you ask.
And yeah. I think that's the part that's so painful, because I think for me, I'm such a big people pleaser. You know, I care about what everyone thinks. And there are some really asshole veterinarians who have a very specific opinion. And if you don't fulfill that, they treat you a certain way. And now you feel like a bad veterinarian.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Now, I think there's quite a few criteria of what a good veterinarian is. And the way I think about it is, you got anyone who's ever played video games, when you first start off with your hero character, right? And you only have like certain level of skill points to put into like strength, health, defense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like it kind of sometimes in some situations you're only allowed a certain amount, and you kind of have to put them into certain things. And then obviously this kind of goes into burnout. Are those who really try too hard to fulfill too much then burn out easily? That's hard to say. That might be a discussion for another time. But Remy, what are your thoughts?
So I think part of it, so I'm going to preface this by saying, obviously I'm not someone who's near their retirement reflecting all the different stages of being a vet, right?
I am, so.
There you go. But my hunch is that it's really dependent on your stage of where you are in your career. Mm-hmm. Right. I think the end result of being a good vet is ultimately how effective are you solving the problems for both your patients and getting their lives improved from your work, mm-hmm. and the clients that own those pets, right? Like I think that's the end result, yeah. That all of our goals should be directed towards that, right? Mm-hmm. That said, I think when you're starting out, like fresh new grad, first day, the qualities that make a good vet as a new grad are going to be, mm-hmm. different than I think someone who's been doing this for 30 years on the opposite side of their career,
mm-hmm. I agree.
Spectrum, you know.
Let me ask you this really quickly.
Yeah.
So you kind of divided into two categories, right? Kind of achieving your, doing your job towards the patient and also kind of for the client. Now, does that then mean if you, let's say you've gained the client's trust, you've created a good relationship, however, the patient did not do well, or the vice versa, where you succeedingly treated the patient, did a medically fantastic job, but the client's unhappy? In those two scenarios, does that mean that you failed?
I mean, I think a lot of vets would perceive that as some degree of failure, because I think we're very hard on ourselves, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, I think to some degree, that's just life, that you're going to, there are plenty of situations where you're going to try your absolute hardest that you can, mm-hmm. in the circumstances that you've been given, and still there can be poor outcomes. Mm-hmm. And we can all think of a variety of different factors that can contribute to that, in terms of if you're short staffed and you have one technician and 10 patients come in simultaneously, you can come up with all these contrived examples kind of approximate it, but ultimately you're going to end up in situations where, in an ideal world where you were properly supported with a good team and you had time and the client didn't have financial constraints and stuff like that, there's potentially a different result than what reality gives you.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately it again comes down to your effort, and your effort just has to be the best that you can give each day.
And I 100% agree. To add on to that, I think in those scenarios with the quote, what we might consider a hard case or a hard situation, or even a failure. I think a good veterinarian would be one that would self-reflect on that and try to then keep that in mind for the next similar case to then try to do better, right? That's essentially, I think that's probably what I would consider a good veterinarian in a nutshell. But yeah, you know, kind of continue from what you were saying.
Yeah, but I guess because thinking more about this, I guess I look at like new grads.
Yeah.
And again, I'm kind of lumping in like the classic small animal vet, right?
We don't talk about large animal. We don't know. We know nothing about horses.
Are there even large animal vets anymore?
Nothing, Jon Snow.
They're like mythical unicorns. I think for new grads, it's been well discussed as far as like being open to learning, don't have a chip on your shoulder, continuing to try to improve what your skills are, you know, things like that, I think are obvious. It's the ones that I would say, at least within our colleagues, the focus is actually, I think, more on the vets that have been out for decades. And I think you kind of spoke on this in one of your earlier.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like I old think school. Vets
my first episode. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's like, okay, there's a lot of opinions that start to develop about vets that have been out for a long time, especially ones that I think have established medicine that was great 30 years ago. You know, and it's like, how do we reconcile the fact that there are things that change over that time period that objectively a lot of younger vets would look at and say, this is not good medicine anymore, at least from their standards. And I think as long as they're still above the line in terms of just modern veterinary practice, they're okay. But it becomes a thing of like, is it optimal? Is it getting the same quality of results that we now know we can get if we have more modern techniques? Mm-hmm. The problem is like, for the vets that are kind of left out there, not really having an avenue for improving. Because the question is, okay, where do they go to improve their skills, right? If they're showing up to their general practice with two doctors out in the suburbs, what do those people do? And the obvious one is CE, right?
That's exactly.
But I have a lot of gripes with, you know, CE.
It's not a perfect system at all.
No, I think my biggest complaint is honestly, like, I've been shocked at the number of CE events, and this is kind of a general announcement, I guess I would want to make to those that are giving these CE talks, that I feel to some degree they are reduced down to the level that you would teach fourth year vet students, just newly being introduced to the topics, right? So we'll have presentations on management of chronic diarrhea, or you'll have a presentation on managing diabetes. And a lot of these talks will be very basic. All right, you have long-acting insulin, short-acting insulin, but there's never like the push for, okay, we have new research that came out of NCSU that now tells us that there's an alteration.
Why do you think that is? That then goes into, is it ultimately you tailor to the demand? If the demand isn't asking for the next level, or at least the percentage of the demand isn't asking for that, is it now because the veterinarians who are attending these CEs truly only have a fourth year level of understanding? Because
I think it's hard to make CE talks. Like I don't minimize the fact that you're asking these vets to devote the time to create these presentations and these talks. And especially if you're asking them to develop talks that are based on new evidence, cutting edge stuff that requires constantly refreshing what you're presenting, right?
Yeah.
But I do think that there's some degree of an implicit, I wouldn't say attitude, but kind of an approach to it. Like, okay, well, a lot of the vets that we're presenting for are these general practice vets that have largely not been exposed to these specialty topics for a while outside of school. So we need to kind of make sure that we stay at the levels that are applicable to general practice. But I don't know, to some degree, I feel like that's not pushing people. Like
You bring up a good point, right? What if we have an established practice that's been around for 20 years and the veterinarian staff, they're like essentially a well-oiled machine where clients are happy, the revenue is coming in, people, they're hiring new vets for the most part, and they're keeping staff. So they're on paper what anyone would expect as a successful hospital. However, their practices are not to the standard of a new internal medicine specialist or critical care specialist, right? They don't want to do the BAL to sample and run a culture. They just want to give antibiotics, or they're just going to start steroids. That then these little niche things then go into, well, any person who's not emotionally attached to this hospital could very quickly say, well, that's just terrible medicine, or that's just not something we do. And if I were to do something like that, and someone, I would hear someone say that about me, that would really make me second guess myself, right? And you were saying we take these things so personally. You know, our identities aren't just people. I mean, we really identify ourselves typically as veterinarians. So if we're seen as a veterinarian who's not doing a good job, we now feel like we're bad people.
Yeah. Right? No, we're definitely very hard on ourselves.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think you just, if you deny people the opportunity to even be exposed to that kind of stuff, because realistically, like, where else are you going to be updated on the newest teachings coming out of universities unless you're actively seeking it out, or you exactly. have a steady flow of new grads coming in saying, well, we got taught this year on these topics. So I think that's really our biggest conduit, to say people should strive to make presentations that 20 or 30% of it should just go completely over the majority of people's heads. And at least if you get the gist of it, it'll, you know, pique your curiosity to say, okay, clearly there's stuff here I don't understand. I should try to find out more about this. And really, you know, that's where pushing ourselves is where we get more
improvement. I get you. Now, knowing, do you think that is the majority of the population, not just veterinarians, just people in general? Is society, do you think
they tend to be,
what do you think? I know people who do, but I also know people who don't, right? There are vets or just people out there who want to collect a paycheck, go for a 9-to-5 and move on with their lives and don't really want to kind of push beyond those limits, right? That goes into, does that make them a bad veterinarian?
Yeah, you know? No, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is someone's, I wouldn't say that I would want to take away their right to live that lifestyle, that mm-hmm. they can work the 9-to-5, make, you know, no one in vet med goes into it to get rich. So, you know, it's just a good quality of life. But I think there is to some degree an acceptance that if you're going into a doctoral level discipline, you're signing up for the fact that you are going to need to maintain a baseline level of modern expertise that you can't just let languish. And I think we're just doing a disservice to
our
community if we're not. Yeah, I mean, it's by extension everybody if we're not, you know, trying to continue to push ourselves. And I guess to summarize it, I just think that I don't know how, and this would be where I would be curious to have people that do give these CE talks kind of really give us insight in terms of what it takes to develop it, or if there is like guidance from the organizers that, you know, hey, we want this kind of a CE talk from you guys. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I think my biggest complaint is going to some of these events that I feel like it's just kind of wasted time. Like, yeah, you have to do it in terms of like the state laws and stuff, but I wish they would push us more than they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I know that there are some of our friends that agree with that. So I wonder if that's kind of a more widespread thing that we could say, hey, we can improve on this.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think there
I know we got totally kind of off track.
No, that's not, no, this is very on track, right? It really, it is ultimately, it's such a wide range of what really makes a good veterinarian. We all have our own opinions. We focused so far more on the objective side in terms of medical knowledge, but there's also just the ability to be someone personable, someone to work with, right? I mean, I'm sure, wasn't there like a shirt that was going around that says veterinarian, but also like psychologist, receptionist, many different jobs that we do as a veterinarian, right? Like, so.
I don't know how I feel about those.
Yeah, no,
I don't know. I might be the odd one out, but I just feel like because people like in the vet world, I feel like we have a little bit of an inferiority complex.
Oh, it's a huge chip on our shoulder for sure.
Yeah. I mean, not to like, I think it is valid that to some degree, society as a whole does not recognize the amount of study and effort that the average vet goes through to become a vet. Mm-hmm. But that said, it can be a little bit ridiculous with some of our colleagues in terms of,
yeah,
you know, comparing ourselves to human med. And I think that, I don't know, for me, that kind of fits in that. And I'm sorry to whoever made that t-shirt. It is clever. And I think it's funny, but
it's a boost of morale, I think.
There
are people, I think, who take it very significantly to heart. And that just comes, I think, down to just our personality as a profession.
Yeah.
And again, mental health, right? And just how hard we are on ourselves and the amount of pressure.
Yeah. But yes, I agree with you that we do wear a lot of hats. And yeah. I think, you know, it's something that the medicine itself is is important. I think that's a foundational thing, right? And everyone would agree with that, right? We have to take the national boards. We have to be able to pass our exams. But then obviously that's where the bedside manner comes in, being able to connect with people, because
so would you,
the pets don't come in by themselves.
Would you rather work with someone who, let's say, is just the most brilliant, knows everything, knows how to save the animal 100% of the time, but curses out the nurses, is such a terrible person to work with around all aspects, all the doctors, all the front desk people, all the clients, all the nurses have something negative to say, complaints every day, right? But I mean, they're everything else, their profit margins for the hospital, their percentage of, you know, it's just, right? I'm 100% in agreement with you. All right. Well, then there's the complete opposite. How about the person who's just so loving, so such a caring, gentle soul, such a treat to work with, but really lags behind on like modern medicine?
Yeah. No, I mean, I first thought you were going to go a little bit of a different direction with that they have this really solid grasp of treatment, which, again, I don't know if there's a vet out there that I would say that it's like the Dr. House of, you know, veterinarians.
I know a couple, at least close enough from what you would say, right? And it's actually what happens is their bedside manner is terrible.
Yeah. No, but I mean, just in terms of like, there's so many gaps in modern medical knowledge, like, and I'm including human med, like everything, that it is just such a complex area of knowledge that it's just, there's obviously some gaps that I don't think anyone can adequately, for any given patient, have 100% success rate with decisions that they make. It's impossible, right? So I think if you would have said that they just were really awkward and they had difficulty communicating with people, I would have said, well, shoot, just stick them in the back and have them, you know, be an ICU doc or whatever, and totally. Just do that. But as soon as you said that they're a jerk to anybody, honestly, anybody, like, to me, that's like, nope.
100%.
Because I really value having nice people that you work around. And like, you can be stressed and you can be
unhappy at times.
Unhappy, but you can't take it out on people just because as brilliant as that person may be and as good as their revenue may be or whatever, there's so many negative externalities that come off of that. And I've met people like that, and I have seen hospital owners that value those people because they look at them in isolation, right? Like, you put them on a spreadsheet and it's just like, well, that's totally our most valuable doctor. But anyone working in that hospital could tell you, well, everyone else can't get their job done. They're quitting because of that person. And it's not obvious from the numbers. And I think a lot of hospitals will eventually run into having employees like that. Mm-hmm. To me, I think I have a low tolerance for team members that act that way. Cause I think, you know, just, it's not.
Toxicity in the workplace is one of the worst things to bring in. Yeah. Is one of the worst qualities.
Cause it affects everything so negatively. It affects the patient care. Clients are going to pick up on it. Like, it is not a good thing to have. So I would rather work with a doctor that has a less solid grasp on the medicine, as long as it was adequate in terms of patient results, that they're not doing anything necessarily harmful, but they may just not have a great grasp on the medicine to the degree that other person would.
Yeah.
But they're open to learn. They're open to come to other doctors in the hospital and say, hey, what are your thoughts on this? Can you help me kind of, reason
exactly.
through?
Exactly. And that's where the good personality comes, right? Like the acknowledgement that, hey, you know what? These other doctors might actually have something worth value for me to learn. Let me have a good attitude. Let me also, put myself in a scenario where I can become better.
Yeah. Veterinary medicine is a team sport.
Yeah.
So anybody that's going through vet school thinking they're going to be the hero on their own, it's just, you're going to be one of those people that are not pleasant to work with. So you really need to be able to be liked by everyone you work around. And it's just, spread the goodwill with everybody and it'll come back to you. So
that is actually where I think for me, the gray area is, that's kind of where I struggle with, right? Let's say you have, cause you're going to have people who, let's say they do a 1-year internship and that's it. And then they're off on their own. And an internship has value in it. And we can go a whole hour into our thoughts about it. And I've already expressed numerous times how I feel about it, but they've got a good amount of fundamental knowledge for the most part, but an internship does not mean you're a well-rounded doctor in terms of overall knowledge either, right? You still need to practice it and fine tune that. But there are people who, internship or not, just go straight into working, have zero lack of additional mentorship from there. And now they're kind of, you have this kind of nebulous area where you're confident, but you aren't exactly doing a very good medical job. But you, maybe you're also like, maybe your staff like you, maybe you also have a good personality, but you're very stubborn on and set in your ways. But the reason why I say this is because we're at this age in our careers where our colleagues who have been in that are starting to show, right? I have people from Ross, because we have a huge Ross community, people who have been there, and now they're giving advice on our Facebook page. And some things are a little bit concerning, and like people will question them, and they're very quick to be like, well, I've been doing this, and I've been dealing with 50 patients a day for the last 5 years. I know what I'm talking about. I've done it. And it's like, maybe this isn't the right thing to say, good or bad veterinarian, but then how do we then categorize this type, this aspect of our field? You know?
Yeah. I mean, would you say in terms of struggling to call it out, or how do we prevent that attitude?
Yeah, both, right? It's a tricky thing. You have people that you go to vet school with, or people who you know, and it's the way I'm saying it is almost if I've entered this nirvana of medical experience and I know where I know exactly what I'm talking about, right? But seeing it from a different angle, when you have these colleagues there was one that one of my relief doctors have mentioned, because we talk about these things, and there is like a handful of vets who are like this, where they make it out, they're thrown in the wolves very early on in their career, and they make it out alive, and now they have this very like set idea of how things should be done. Otherwise, they're good people. I mean, it's not like they're doing anything. Again, they're still maintaining some level of survival and their survival rates in their cases, right? They're not going off the bridge here, but just they're also not willing to kind of move forward with growth.
I think it's for anybody, I think it's hard to receive criticism, right? But I think it's easier when it comes from people that you trust and that are your friends. I think what has been hard in the past few years is because a lot of the hospitals have been so busy and people have been so stressed that it does start to foster these work environments that mm-hmm. you don't have a good opportunity to kind of just sit down and critique small things here and there. Yeah. You're just working around other stressed people, and attitudes just start to solidify without any sort of communication breaking those barriers down, right? So then that's where you get, and especially in every vet hospital, there's cliques that start to form. There's the one doctor no one really likes working with. Always happens. And it's, I think, to some degree, just because when you push a team to the max, it just kind of, it brings out the worst in everybody. Mm-hmm. When you kind of go down to your lowest level of training in terms of medicine, social aspects, like everything. So yeah. To some degree, I don't know, it's because it's like, well, how do you fix it? And I think part of it is just having a healthy environment where you can critique each other without the stress of everything else in a vet hospital happening.
Yeah. Communication's
influencing
key.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
But I will say that Colorado State, which is where I went to vet school, has communications classes and like foundations and stuff that helps you.
That's why I wanted to go there for my clinical year. You guys have a department specifically for communications, which
I thought was so cool. I don't know how common that is in other vet schools. Like, I guess my assumption was that that's just part of the curriculum everywhere, mm-hmm. but my understanding is maybe that isn't. I don't know.
I screwed up because I actually asked the communications department. So CSU has a specific department in their teaching hospital where it's not for students. They just have hired people to go over any questions, estimates, feelings with clients. It could be for a bill. It could be the loss of their pet. They can just kind of give them someone to communicate with. I screwed up because I knew about this, and that's all I wanted to go to CSU. And I went to the department and said, hey, like, can I like shadow you guys for a week? I'd love to see how you guys talk to your clients, how you guys manage these difficult conversations. And they said yes. And that I just never followed up. I just, you know, you get busy, you have all the excuses. And I should have, anyone who's at CSU or who's going to CSU for an externship, they said yes to me. This was like 6 years ago. I don't know if they're going to say yes again, but I think it's a good idea reaching out, or whatever school, to really shadow these facilities with such a unique department, because you know, as we're saying, it seems like communication workability is probably one of the biggest strengths to have as an individual or as a veterinarian.
And specifically what you're mentioning is the Argus Institute.
Yes, which
is
yes.
They're effectively, they're like advocates for the client that also work with the doctors that are, it's just, I think that missing link that a lot of vets wish they had, because there's so many situations. And I think this is especially prevalent in ER where you are time constrained. There are some situations where you have only a couple minutes to tell somebody the worst news that they've ever gotten about their pet. And you would absolutely desire to have a half hour to really kind of give them the space to process it and understand it. But you just don't have that time because you have something else back there that's dying right now. So it would be amazing if every vet hospital had the ability to have a client advocate to be able to sit down and say, look, I'm sorry the doctor hasn't been able to talk to you much about this, but let me just kind of fill you in while they're out doing this. And it's like to have people that are capable of doing that.
It's an art too, to be able to do that. So it's easier said than done. But
yeah, well, there's so many vet hospitals. It's not, I mean, it would be amazing if every vet hospital could pay to have someone like that on their team, but it's just.
Cause they're not vet techs, right? Or even vets. I think they may have like at least some type of college degree in psychology, right? I think that's what it, or communications, I feel.
I don't know.
Okay. I feel like that's what I remember. Cause
they're good at what they do.
They're fantastic at what they do. Yeah. CSU all the way, man. You know, pivoting a little bit to kind of really probably at the core of why we question ourselves is essentially imposter syndrome, right? Is a thing that we throw around quite a bit, which I think it is something just based on our personalities, us being so hard on ourselves. What is your experience with imposter syndrome?
I think it is present always to some degree. Mm-hmm. I think it would be weird if you didn't have it just because to be entirely secure about your skill set and your knowledge, I think that's where complacency starts to grow, right? So it's only when it starts to become a dominating part of your perception of yourself and it interferes with your ability to function that becomes excessive, right? That it's no longer productive. If you have a little bit, I'd say that it motivates you to say, okay, I haven't seen Sharpei fever in 5 years. Let me just double check the quick consult manual or whatever, just to make sure that there's nothing that I haven't forgotten about. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's healthy, right? Because I think our clients would want us to do that just from the standpoint that they want the best outcome from their pet. Mm-hmm. And whatever you need to do to refresh your knowledge is important, but definitely it hits you hard when you're first starting out. And you just have this oh crap moment where you're just like, I'm responsible for these pets.
Yeah.
And you don't have your faculty over you. You don't have, you know, it's you. And I don't know. I guess it's something I haven't really thought of in terms of, is it a predominant enough issue that we aren't paying enough attention to? I don't know. I guess this is the first time you're really making me think of.
Yeah,
of,
that's a good question. I mean, I guess an analogy I have for imposter syndrome would probably be like your cortisol levels, right? If you have too much, then you have Cushing's. If you have too little, then you have Addisonian.
You measured a vet's basal cortisol just on any given day.
And maybe there's a correlation with imposter syndrome, right? I've got to do a test on that. Your question was how prevalent it is. I think that there is quite a bit, and I think it just comes down to how people project it or how people deal with it. When you look at, and I hate to go into like social gender norms and things like that, but when you look at your cis heterosexual males in the veterinary field, a lot of them tend to be a little bit more stubborn on their growth. At least, sorry, I mean, from some of the ones I've seen, I'm obviously not listing any names because
most
of the ones, you know, and those are typically the ones who I kind of mentioned where they either do an internship or they just go straight into GP, very little mentorship, and then have this, because they've survived it, you know, developed a very hardened core or surface of knowledge, right? And there has to have been some level of imposter syndrome at that point where the way that some people deal with it is by completely shutting it off and just go full force, head first into it. versus other people will very much sometimes shut down, might even go to some type of panic attack, right? And that could be obviously in combination of the caseload and all those things. And, you know, I mentioned my panic attack in the middle of my ER stint in 2021, yeah, or 2022. And when I reflect on it, I don't think that imposter syndrome was very much the primary cause. But when you're constantly overworking yourself and in a scenario where there's complex cases and you're constantly challenging yourself, there is always going to be that cloud of self-doubt that probably plays is a big player into that.
Yeah. I mean, now that, because you're making me think back on like the people I would, because it's not like a topic that I've discussed at length with a lot of of our colleagues. I would say that the vets that I assume suffer from very little imposter syndrome, or at least show no outward indication of it, tend to be the ones that I think they can put on a very good bedside manner and presentational front to clients. And I think that they tend to be the ones that I would probably peg as not having the highest quality medical prowess or decision making. And it's something that some of the vets that I've known that have definitely like very obvious imposter syndrome are some of the ones I would say have some of the best medical decision making and like intuition. You know, and they almost seem kind of opposite.
I agree with you. The last doctor at the GP I worked at, very unique story, essentially had a whole career before veterinary medicine, so came into this. And so when she first got out of vet school, like in her mid-30s, or even early 40s, she was treated poorly, but her mentorship was really bad. Her initial experience was terrible. So when she entered the hospital she's at now, there was a huge, huge, huge amount of imposter syndrome, and she still very much doubts herself a lot. However, she's like a walking encyclopedia. She does CEs like every week. She is so on top of like just constant learning. So you definitely have a point there.
Well, I think the hard part is that you look at what's rewarded by clients, and I will say that the vets that seem to have almost no outward imposter syndrome, that really just are like, jump in, let's do this, from what I've seen, clients love that. But I think that those are sometimes the vets that all the other vets look at, and you're like, you know, don't know if I would make some of those decisions. Yeah. Yeah. And then there are the ones that try to really discuss the complex nuances and, you know, give a more full featured picture of what's going on with people's pets. And I think sometimes it comes across as a very wishy-washy, well, you're just being a nerd that's sitting there giving me a bunch of facts, you know, I need a leader in this situation. So I think that's where it just kind of reinforces that you start to question, okay, are you a bad vet? Cause you're not cavalier in getting in there and potentially oversimplifying a situation that's actually fairly complex.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's just, there's kind of multiple facets for sure that I think kind of affect that, but it's something that I think as far as judging if you're a good vet or not, I will say that I think the vast majority of vets out there are very good.
I agree.
You know,
we should have probably started with that too.
Yeah. And honestly, I forget who it was. I was talking to someone that I think it was like a bus driver or something, that he said that as soon as he found out that I was a vet, he said that I have liked every single vet that I've met. I think they're some of the best people just generally all around. And I think that overall, one thing our community can be proud of is almost everyone is highly ethical and well-intentioned and good-natured. And I think that those are very important traits that do factor into whether you're a good, you know, vet or not. It's just, I think that people being people have various abilities in communicating, and sometimes your own biases that you grow up with or whatever can factor into what kind of recommendations you make. Sometimes your style of communication is not going to jive with,
you can't please everybody.
Yeah. I mean, there, you have such a variation because you flip it around and you say, okay, are clients these days more difficult to communicate with and mm-hmm. connect with? And I think that there's discussion to say that, it, and again, this is just from my personal experience, that there are absolutely people that are very difficult to try to get them to make a decision or to work productively with them or be able to have like a high trust bond.
I mean, we are working in Florida where a lot of those very straightforward New York personalities kind of come down. So who knows yes. if it's really just a location thing, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it also depends on your own personality, right? Yeah. But it is an art to be able to walk into a room with people you've never met and determine, are these people that really need to be eased in mm-hmm. to bad news? Are they people that are going to get frustrated if you're sitting there easing them in and they want it straight and they feel like you're BSing them?
Yep.
If you're trying, you know, and you can go from one room to the next and they're polar opposites.
Completely different. Yeah. And this is something I mean, I personally take pride in that ability to kind of read a room and kind of gauge, but there are still times where I am unpleasantly surprised about how a patient, how a client or a pet owner can react to just a discussion.
Yeah.
It's pretty shocking.
It's a tough part of it. And I don't think that there's, I think that's one of the ways that vets can really feel bad about themselves is that there are going to be appointments that don't seem to go that well. And part of it is just you have very different styles of communication and there's another vet that potentially would be a better connection with them.
Yep.
I think it's just important to recognize it and say like, look, you know, we tried the best with the situation we had today. And
this goes into kind of like probably the final part of this discussion. And this is, you mentioned this very early on, this kind of more now advice for our new graduates or veterinary students, kind of what to expect in your journey of becoming a quote good veterinarian. You know, again, we can talk about mentorship and how you can go about that in another video. But I think the key thing that we've kind of brought home is also trying to focus on your ability to work well with, or your ability to work well as a team member, you know, your teamwork. I think that for my first year and a half, again, I mentioned this before, I had a pretty much lack of any solid mentorship, but I was able to kind of gain that confidence. I think my first imposter syndrome was kind of dealt with in terms of being able to create connections with clients. And I was able to establish that skill set early on. And then of course, jumping into ER specialty was then where I started getting more and more medical experience. You know, do you have any kind of advice or kind of any words to say to new grads or vet students who are listening in?
I think it's hard given how it seems very location dependent. Mm-hmm. It seems very dependent on whatever little segment of the field you end up in. Because I think the approach that someone in rural Alabama working in mixed, like their approach that works for them and their clients and their team is going to be very different from someone working downtown Seattle or mm-hmm. whatever and exotics only.
Yeah. Well, I think you said a good one just now, actually. I think in many aspects, unless you're not an incredibly difficult person, if there is a client who is not doing well with you or requests to see another doctor or has any issues with you, it's likely not your fault. And I feel like for those who are just graduating or coming out there and they walk out of a situation, they feel like, oh man, this client really doesn't like me. Might not be your fault. For me, I feel like I was very hard on myself. And I know a lot of people still are, even X amount of years afterwards. But I've come to just think, okay, well, if there's a scenario where a client is upset with me, I honestly don't feel like, let's say you are not the smartest person and understanding the problem at hand. If you're honest and you say, hey, I don't know what's going on, I really think you should go to this hospital and you refer out, then that's going to be what that it is. If they have an issue with that and they judge you as a doctor and label you as a bad doctor, that's not on you.
Yeah. You know, I mean, well, I think if anything, I commend clients that are willing to ask for another doctor because that's an awareness of the potentially it's just a personality mismatch.
So there was also a time where there were clients who, I remember when I was my first year, they asked to see another veterinarian. And the reason was because they saw how much experience I had, because they read my profile and said, okay, mm-hmm. I just graduated, right? That's going to happen. And that's just what it is. I guess for me, I think the sweet spot right now for me is vets who are somewhere between 5 to 15 years out, maybe even 5 to 10 years out. I think that's
kind like of for you personally, if you were
personally, if I were a client, and this kind of goes into our almost our coma, but like right now with my daughter, all the types of appointments we see, right? Would I rather see like an 80-year-old pediatrician, or would I rather see someone who's 45, right? And kind of has a very similar personality. And so when they see someone,
I'm sure somebody who's, you know, closer to the 80-year-old would probably.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it was. The people who decided to choose someone else, they wanted my boss because they could relate to him better.
My suspicion is it's probably to some degree influenced by you want someone similar to your age because you want that connection, I think is part of it. But yeah, I mean, as far as like people reacting poorly, I think I'm happy that the vast majority of clients I've worked with, like they've been really, like they've given a lot of positive feedback, and I've had some really wonderful clients that have been super appreciative. But I think for the small percentage that it could have gone better in an appointment, I think one of the good pieces of advice that I have heard is that, especially if you're in like a professional role, you're wearing a uniform, you have a role to serve, if they're upset over something, oftentimes I was told by someone that they're often upset with the person in the uniform, right? It's not necessarily you, as like you, mm-hmm. you and all of your experiences and your culmination of who you are as a person. It's the role you're serving and the capacity, like just the face of it.
I believe that.
What becomes hard is that some people, and I think this has been a little bit of an increasing problem, that you look at the clients that really take it upon themselves to try to inflict as much emotional damage as possible, almost like in a vindictive manner.
It's rare.
I look at some of our colleagues that have been subjected to that, and some of them, it was just like completely overboard for anything that was deserved. So there are those people out there. They will always be out there. And I think it's hard for those people that are in that situation to disconnect. Mm-hmm. You can't just say, oh, they're upset at the uniform, because they're trying everything they can to try to throw it on you.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the solution to that aspect is, because I think it's something that every person in vet school and coming out of vet school, like that is something that you have to be prepared for.
I think it's very few people are just naturally going to be able to be likable from it by everyone, right? You have to kind of eventually find out your own way to communicate. And I think it's an understanding of who you are, how people perceive you, and then of course having a good understanding of just more and more types of people out there. And that's just an experience thing.
Some of it is, I think, just a recognition that you could be the best doctor on the planet, mm-hmm. but if someone comes in at 3 a.m. on meth and they
that's happened
$20 oh yeah and they have $20 in their pocket, and they just got in a fight with whoever in their family, and they just are in a real bad mood, and everything is going wrong, and then their pet has something fairly severe going on, and trying to have a conversation, those are the ones that can go very, very poorly. And it's not one of, you know, for some of you can't even have a rational conversation, but then they start getting angry, they start making death threats at you, and it's just, you know, you can do everything right and still have things go extraordinarily poorly. And I think that that's just something important for,
there's a lot of uncontrollable factors in our care. You know, it's funny, we obviously very strongly believe that a strong component of a good veterinarian is someone who is good with clients, obviously, and good with a good team member. Now, that being said, I mean, what if they're a good team member? And we don't have to touch into this, because I mean, it's more of a rhetorical question, but you know, how about someone who has decent medicine, is really good with nurses and the doctors, but clients just don't like working with them? And I apologize for the barking dogs and the crying baby in the back.
No, I mean, that's
to the listeners.
Yeah. So you're asking if just they don't connect with clients well, but everything else is fine.
I mean, just because we've harped so much on client communication and client doctor relationship, which I very much value, it just now goes like, how about people who just have some type of, that's just their personality, have a hard time connecting with others?
I mean, I guess that just seems like one of those things that's so individual, right? Because if
I know some that's who are like that.
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, I think you're just judged on things you can't control, like your appearance, your height, you know, just stuff that people react differently to. And I think in those situations, there's to some degree a little bit of a self-awareness that, okay, I can't change any of those things. Mm-hmm. So what do I want to do with my career and everything to just make it so that I'm not constantly subjected to these undesirable aspects?
Yeah.
I think if it's something where you just are awkward communicating with people, you just aren't comfortable having hard conversations, whatever. If it's something that you can try to improve your communication skills, the fact that now that we have classes on communication in vet school, I think that that's an opportunity to improve in a way that you may not have. But there's speech classes, there's, mm-hmm. I mean, even for some people, if they have underlying anxiety, that potentially do they go the route of trying to
medication,
counseling, like whatever, to make themselves feel more comfortable, more confident to be able to go in the room and mm-hmm. talk to strangers. I think that is something to look into, right? Because it's an integral part of your job.
Yeah. This does go back into, I think, the main point that we said very early on is like, I think what makes a good veterinarian in a very blanket term is one who's aware of who they are and is striving to still constantly improve themselves. If I had to encompass it into one.
To boil it down.
So, because again, it doesn't necessarily have to mean that you're the smartest person in the room. It doesn't also mean that you're the easiest to work with necessarily, but I think it definitely helps.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Okay. Cool, guys. Anyone have any questions, please comment, like, subscribe, follow.
You what do else a little do we button talk up about? There or
right,
something.
Right. Let me see. These videos nowadays, they have a thumbs up that show up. I don't even know.
I don't know.
Zoom does that. Only for me. Maybe because I have a Mac. All right. OMA sarcoma. Dr. Drake, what's your OMA for today?
I mean, my OMA was, I went to a great concert yesterday, but it also ties into my sarcoma. So we ended up seeing Anne Berlin. Mm-hmm. Which they're changing lead singers, which is a big thing for a lot of bands. But,
yeah.
So it's kind of like a farewell concert tour for the previous lead singer.
And that's one of Steph's favorite bands, right? Is that
the favorite?
Okay, because she told me that. I remember, and I never heard of them, but that name
Went
out to me. Okay,
most people recognize like a few of their songs at least, but
yeah,
and then like Hawthorne Heights, but yeah, I mean it was a good show. It ties into my sarcoma though because. We were up at the front and there was this girl a couple spots down from us that, you know how musicians, like they'll bring it down and just sing some very.
And a little bit softer now.
Yeah. Like they just bring it down, now. Have a little bridge there. And I don't have a problem with people singing. Like that's not an issue, but she was trying her best Yoko Ono impression. I don't know if people have seen that video, but look like on YouTube, just look up Yoko Ono singing. And I think like the original version and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about, that she was just belting like, like at
totally
the top of her lungs.
The mood.
I was just like, how can you not have enough self-awareness to realize that no one paid to listen to that?
Lack of self-awareness is probably going to be like the sarcoma of every, that's
like. But otherwise, it was good.
That's terrible. Okay.
It was good.
Okay.
There's another one tonight. So it's 2 days.
Are you guys
so I'm hoping she's not showing up.
Oh, you guys are going tonight? Again. No way.
Well, because it's like, it's the farewell thing, right? Hey, so you got to go to both.
You guys enjoy it. I hope. Yeah. Tell Steph I said have a good time. I'm glad that she's. Yeah. Are you guys getting any merch?
So we got like posters and stuff. And she has like every shirt that they've sold.
Oh, okay.
So there's like one that
she needs to.
She was debating on getting. It was, I don't know if you've seen the meme with the. Like the woman yelling at the cat.
Oh yeah, yeah,
over
of
broccoli.
Course.
And it was just like, how could you change your lead singer? And then it has the lead singer's name over the cat.
That's funny.
Kind of funny.
That's but actually really fun. I'm glad they actually. That's actually positive self awareness, right?
Yeah. No, I mean they're owning it totally.
Yeah,
but
that's cool.
Yeah. No, it was a good time.
Okay. Let's see. All right. So let's see. You did your OMA and sarcoma. So I guess my OMA is not so much like a current thing, but something I like to bring to light to some people who aren't familiar. And this is some, I mean, people usually who are in like the science field for some reason tend to really fall into this type of niche. But you can see behind me, I have a bunch of board games. This is not even all of them, just because we kind of have someone here living with us from Singapore on and off. And she's currently using that sometimes as a sweater holder. But I have a whole shelf of board games.
Where's there room for a sweater?
A little cabinet right there, right behind me, like next to these books, there's some shirts and stuff.
Super generous with your space.
I know, right? I don't even attend to my crying baby, okay? I promise I'm going to go take care of her, I promise. But there, people obviously hear about Monopoly. They talk about board games of like, yeah, like, you know, Life or Mousetrap and all that. Even Cranium is a popular one that people probably know about. Ticket to Ride. And then when you talk about actual board games or quote actual board games, a lot of people have heard or at least played Settlers of Catan, which I kind of call the gateway drug into like deep diving into board games.
The real board games.
The real. And honestly, I'd have to, I'm kind of a snob at this point because I've delved so deep into it. Granted, I have like SpongeBob games too. But
is that the next level up?
That's the next level, man.
Wait, so what's above Catan then in your
opinion? Oh my gosh, everything else, dude. Like, so if you go, yeah, I mean, Catan is, it's fun. I'm not going to get too into this unless anyone requests I do a podcast about board games. I'll totally.
All right, we're halfway through the podcast. Let's go for the other half.
So,
wait. So, have you been like super into board games this whole time? And I just never
whole time.
I never knew this about you all these years.
Is that really? Huh. I'm pretty open about it
at one point. I guess I don't know. Like, do you have dozens of them beyond what
dozens.
You have on your bookshelf here?
Dozens. I thought I was like kind of bad, but there, I'm nowhere near the level of some people who like spend thousands. I might have probably spent about $1,000 in total on board games, maybe more. But like there, for example, I met someone who was a clinical pathologist. He's now retired. I somehow like went to his house and I went into his office and he just had literally hundreds, if not thousands of board games stacked from the ground touching his ceiling all throughout. And then I'd go into his bathroom and there's board games. And then I'd go into the closet.
Okay, starting to sound like games. A hoarder situation.
Right. I mean, hey, not bringing up his name, but he's a big collection guy.
Wait, actually in the bathroom?
Yeah, going into the floor of the bathroom and then out into the closet. I should probably give him a little bit of credit. He was currently.
Yeah, I'm sorry, because I know our field is super small, so he might actually see this. No, but like, he had to move things. Board games are okay. It's just, I don't.
He was in a transition period. He had someone living in a current space that was being occupied, so we had to move everything.
That's
and it was scattered. Okay. Yeah. So, he will buy board games daily. He would go. So, he was the one who introduced me to board game conventions. So, 2 years ago, last year, on the summer, I spent 5 days and five nights in Orlando at a board game convention. That's actually where VMX is, or where they used to be. And I spent 5 days and five nights for playing board games, 16 hours a day. And you're just in this giant ballroom with like 200 tables and this half the, like there's a corner, like a quarter, that filled a quarter of the whole ballroom with just board games you sign up to play. And you check it in, you check it out. And there's new games, or there's games been out for years. There's this whole community of board gamers who are way beyond where I am, but I'm at the part where like I've scratched the surface and I'm aware of it and I kind of know the obsessiveness of it. I've like, if you're someone who goes on Kickstarter and buys these board games 2 years ahead of time on the daily, that's like where those extreme board gamers are. I am at the point where I've paid for a couple Kickstarter games, but not all of them. And it's a good.
Wait, huh? So what is the average board game enthusiast like? Are they?
Dude, that's the thing, man. It is such
anybody.
Honestly, I feel like you would love board games. It's such like,
really?
You're a critical thinker. You love kind of working through problems, and there's going to be I guarantee you there is a board game out there that you love for anybody. It used to be like a total like dudes thing, right? So like they'd have a bunch of like things that are very attractive or like very like, you know, these guns and very like war battle, you know, resource grabbing, conquering games. And those are still kind of fun. But now they've come out with such more, not just for like gender specific roles, but just all ages as well. The two biggest ones that are very popular, one's called Wingspan. Okay. And as you can see, I have three of the expansions and the base game. And
I've heard of it.
Oh, dude, we have to play it. Okay. Next time I come up there, I'm going to bring it. Yeah. It's such a beautiful game. I'm spending so much time on this.
It's fine. I mean, I've never explored the world. Like, I don't even have a board game in this house. Zero
playing cards.
So new to me.
It's
I've played Catan though.
Yeah. Catan is cool. Catan's all right. I can mess with Catan. It's just, there are so many better games out there now. Like in the last decade or probably the last 5 to 10 years, things have really stepped up. And Wingspan is a pretty good family game, but the artwork, the mechanisms of how you can build points and win is way more unique than just, you get victory points by taking over these people and winning and destroying. It's not like that anymore, right? It's like, you collect eggs or certain card values, there's bonus rounds, there's so many intricate new techniques and how you can do well. And for example, like when I play with my wife, Dr. Pamela Coloretta, when we would play more of these straightforward mechanisms, like more old school, like Catan, she would become very frustrated because that's just not the way she likes to strategize her brain. She wins in Wingspan like at least 50% of the time. And it's just because the way that it's just more suitable for different types of ways that brain wavelengths, right? So nowadays there's so many fun ways, so many board, thousands of games you can play. And I'm still constantly buying some. I just bought a couple just in the last couple of days too. But
anyone doing, because now I'm thinking, like, what do you introduce to a board game convention? Like,
yeah,
you know how there's been the craze, well, now it's dead, but the metaverse thing that they were doing recently, mm-hmm. with Mark Zuckerberg. Is anyone doing like augmented reality?
Oh yes,
board games.
Yes,
for like,
absolutely. Anything you can think of, like, yeah, you put on your iPad. I mean, they have some cool things that are integrated through your app. I think those are still kind of gimmicky. I don't think it's perfect just yet. You know, Wingspan, you can even download on your phone now. I just like the actual physical aspect of it. I like being present because the whole point of it is to socialize in person for me, right? There's still a bunch of people who play online. One that I'd probably introduce you to aside from Catan is something called Pandemic. And this is another one of those more, it's not as like mainstream as Monopoly, but if you, the next level, the people who know Catan might know Ticket to Ride or also know like Pandemic. And it's also kind of suitable in the last few years, but this is one where we collaborate as a team and we're not against each other. We're working together to kind of fight the disease of the entire world. And it's fun.
Is it like that phone game?
Plague. Are you talking about Plague? Plague. Yeah, you're the disease, right? You're trying to kill everybody. This one, you're trying.
So it's like opposite.
Opposite. Okay. And this is the first game that Pam and I played because we're not very good with competing against one another typically. So when we worked together, it was a really fun time. So
yeah, I didn't know this about you.
Oh yeah. Oh,
that's cool though.
Yeah, So yeah, that's my OMA.
So yeah, what's the sarcoma?
My sarcoma. I know, right?
Don't have enough.
Can we keep talking about board games? My sarcoma.
I'll make a whole episode about it, I guess.
I know, I totally can. I absolutely can. I mean, there's so many videos too. All right. Well, on YouTube, you can find like, my top 20 board games. And, you know, they get views.
It's your second career.
One of these days. I actually thought about doing either making my own board game or opening up a board game cafe. But that would be a passion project. You know, it's very hard to even like just make ends meet. Because you'd just be throwing away money on the monthly. If I could find a way just to not even make money, but just have it just build on itself, I would totally do it. But
board game cafe. I mean, this is where now we're digging into the finances of board game cafes. But like, I would assume that they make most of their money just on selling
drinks,
food, and drinks, yeah, right? Exactly. Like, it's not.
Well, now you're
just a way to get them in the door.
Now you go into the complication of like, well, if you're selling food, are you going to get the board games dirty? What kind of food are you? And the cheapest one's fried food, right? So probably the highest profit margin is fried food. So like if you're trying to maximize and sell French fries, well, now you're going to have these greasy people who play board games aren't typically the most clean anyways, right? So like, let's be real. So like, you know, are they going to treat your games with respect? And then, you know, are you want to serve alcohol? Because that would be fun. Absolutely. Yeah. But then now you have people getting drunk, spilling all of your board, you know, so there's that aspect. And granted, board games aren't typically that expensive, but there are that can be several hundred dollars, right?
Wasn't Catan expensive?
No, I mean, when it's on sale,
not compared to what you.
No, man, I got. Yeah, you can't see some of the games. I just put down like $200 something on a game I'm getting next year, and I'm excited. Oh. Yeah, I played it at the convention. They ran out. The company ran out, but now they came out with an expansion that I bought with the base game, which is why it cost so much. But anyway,
and so I suppose you wouldn't. Yeah, because you wouldn't stock the cheap ones. Anyone who's going to go to a board game cafe is not going to be interested in the cheap ones. They're going to want the expensive.
No, not always. No, really, because some
that
people
would be kind of a problem.
Some people would go in and they're just pretty open to learning, right? Because like, oh, wow, board game cafes. Okay, let me start off with something simple and easy. And then there are those who then want to jump in. But those who are like really into like the hardcore expensive or like intricate ones, they already probably established that kind of etiquette of taking care of those things. So, all right, Sarcoma. You know, I guess my biggest inspiration in terms of podcast content is probably Elisa Schlesinger. This actually is not really anything her content, but this is something that she harped on a lot, especially when she was pregnant with her first kid. I actually haven't been listening to her podcast too much recently, but when she was pregnant with her first child, she mentioned how literally everything is focused. Our demographic, kind of like mid-20s to mid-30s, middle class, upper middle class, you know, white, Caucasian, Asian, model minority, whatever you want to categorize, we're like the ideal demographic for people with kids in terms of a marketing standpoint. Like every baby child company is like, we're just the target, and I'm constantly getting ads about this, and it's just like, you need this $150 robe, birthing robe, or else you're a terrible parent and your child is gonna suffer. And it's very overwhelming, and I've been overwhelmed even when Pam was pregnant. Pam could probably hear me through the walls here, and she knows I say this all the time. What's even more frustrating is like, we then start to get more understanding of illnesses, right? We talk about tongue tie, we talk about torticollis, we talk about these milestones of how to achieve things. And Mika's doing very well. She's very healthy, but yet we still can't help but just, especially as people with a medical background, get so focused on like the specific details of, okay, well, 3 months she's at this. Oh, she's not turning her head to the left at this much as compared to the right. And then you then have this, suddenly the formula, the algorithm on your phone goes, oh, do you want to know more about how badly your baby's doing? Here.
It's listening in on your conversations.
Yeah, here's a video on a baby with scoliosis. You know, and it's like, oh crap, all right, now we got to see a doctor, right? And so I mean, there's a benefit just because we have more knowledge and we can prevent potential issues that going down, I guess.
Well, we also have enough knowledge to be dangerous with it and
exactly
create problems for ourselves because we overanalyze everything, right?
Yeah, my sarcoma isn't the fact that we have this data and also these resources available. I think my sarcoma is the sense that it's so overwhelming and it's impossible to filter through the scams, right? You can't really know until you try it, and then you try it, okay, and then now you've either wasted your time or you through a free trial, or you've wasted your money through a non-free trial. And it's just been so overwhelming to have to have either people email me, text me, go through Instagram, or even just straight up knock on your door saying, hey, do you want this for your kid?
Have you tried? I mean, and this, I guess, only works for when you're actively seeking out certain businesses or services or whatever. But have you tried searching for stuff related to like babies and infant care through ChatGPT versus like Google?
I have not.
Yeah. I'm curious because basically, you know, obviously ChatGPT being a large language model is not designed for accuracy, right? It's a fundamentally a pattern recognition engine, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something that I would caution anyone using it to trust anything stated as fact as actual fact, right? Because it's not made to do that. That said, it actually seems to be fairly good at a quasi Google replacement. And I've used it in terms of just searching, well, what are some decent recommendations for strollers or something like that? And it can actually kind of serve a purpose of aggregating
I could see that.
Or something like that. And then it can provide links that you can look and you can kind of sift out all of the ads. Because, you know, Google search these days, how many ads do you have? And how many blog posts do you have where they just ramble for five pages and then tell you something that's just garbage?
To tie this all together, we should actually ask ChatGPT what makes a good veterinarian.
All right, let's do it. Let's do it right now. All right, so it gave me 10.
Okay.
So a good veterinarian, according to ChatGPT, exhibits medical expertise, practical skills, such as proficiency in diagnostic, surgery, and treatment, communication skills, compassion, problem-solving abilities, patience, they're detailed-oriented, adaptability, strong ethics, and continuous learning.
That's Look pretty good. I got to get, you pay for ChatGPT, right? So you have 4.0?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I
expect them to raise the price eventually because I don't know. It's only like $20 a month, but
that's not bad at all.
I feel like it's value, especially for the coding aspect is helpful in terms of finding libraries. And
Well, there you have it, guys. So we this is what the general public also agrees on. So it looks like we're kind of on par with it. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We'll be back next week for another one. Dr. Drake, you got anything else you want to say?
No, it's kind of fun how we meandered through.
I know. We went full
now
circle.
I need to learn the financials of a board game cafe and see if this is something
we should do together, huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, guys. We'll catch you guys later.
All right, later.